things we've done. So yesterday we took that kind of re-expression to first order of the Einstein tensor under some assumption, and then we were trying to make a connection with what happens really far from the source, in particular to make the connection with gravitational waves. We chose a very particular gauge to see that very explicitly. So today we're going to complement that, now trying to make contact with the production. So we want to connect the production gravitational waves with what we discussed yesterday, at least the properties of the gravitational waves. But incidentally, I'll just for kind of frame a little bit what one of the things we would like to do is connect with, say, what is the gravitational waves of a binary system? Let's say they have two masses. We're going to consider them sufficiently separate so that they cannot change. And if you want these stars themselves sufficiently fluffy so that they don't change, they don't affect significantly the gravitational field, so that we can keep thinking that our approximation is reasonable. As a historical remark, first one, but this I'm Mike, so I'll just give you half the remark. So Einstein's paper on gravitational waves was actually basically on the non-existence of gravitational waves. So he sends the paper to the referee, to the journal, I think it was PRD. He gets sent to a referee. The referee spots what was wrong with the paper and anonymously informs back the editor, which then gets to Einstein. And Einstein, the story goes, so I'm not so sure about this part, gets annoyed at this. Says, I sent you a paper for a publication. I didn't send you a paper for it to be distributed around. I'm going to take it and publish it elsewhere. And then the paper gets published in a rather kind of secondary obscure paper, the Journal of Something in New England. However, the title gets changed along the way from the non-existent to the existent. So he does take with his collaborator, who was it, Rosen perhaps, the input. And later, many years later, we do know who that person is. That person is Robinson. So when we say gravitational waves have confirmed the prediction of Einstein, well, in some sense, yes, it confirms the prediction of a theory of Einstein, but the prediction is Robinson. And of course, the first, and I'm sure you've known, the first Nobel Prize on gravitational waves was given by Hulse and Taylor, who painstakingly measured a binary pulsar. And then if you pick the graph that shows kind of essentially the separation over time of the pulsar, so it's just eccentricity over time, you get the data. You can see the data of that was the observations together with the prediction from general relativity in the weak field. And especially towards the latter years, the dots of the observations that include the error bars have to be enlarged so that you actually see them. So it's amazingly accurate for that case. So anyway, so that's put in context. However, now we took a particular gauge that was convenient for us for the purpose that we had yesterday. Today, we're going to have a slightly different purpose. We want to connect with the source.
What was the
y-axis? So essentially, well, some separation or some measure of, in reality, it was eccentricity or the semi-major axis. So there are several graphs that show this. And again, the agreement is extraordinary. So now, our goal is slightly different. We want to connect with the source and the production of gravitational waves. And hopefully, we get to this. So let's start first by, we go there, but as I said, we're going to choose a slightly different gauge. And we're going to start by first considering something else. So associated to the metric perturbation H, we're going to define a bar metric perturbation, which is just the original one minus its trace. And this is called the trace reverse form. And this is just a convenience, because when we put that in terms of this h bar, that expression simplifies quite a bit. Lots of things get combined into something that is much more manageable. And in particular, if you say, now I'm going to choose a gauge. This is a gauge choice that has the derivative of this h bar to zero. And this is related to, I think, He was, no, he was asking the Lorentz gauge. And this is in analogy to what you might recall in electromagnetism. You would have chosen a gauge where kind of the divergence of these four auxiliary vector was zero. So you're doing essentially the same thing, but we're working with a tensor. So this, if you choose that and plug it into there and write it in terms of h bar, now Einstein's equation simplify considerably. And then GAB happens to be minus 1/2 box h bar B, where box is the standard box in flat space then. Yes?
Yesterday we derived that in transverse
priceless gauge, yes.
We had del A of HAB is 0 instead of H bar AB.
So we didn't have H A bar AB, so we had the H, so yesterday with that gauge, we had H A 0 equal to 0. Here we're going to, and then we introduce all that, those tensors, the spatial tensors to kind of lock into things. Here, notice at this point, we still have all of them are alive. So A and B, we're letting all the components be non-trivial. But we have chosen given coordinates where H bar AB represented in those coordinates have divergence zero, or the derivative along one of the components. So now, then this, using Einstein's equations, implies box of HAB is minus 16 pi G AB. So our goal now is to work with this, simply because we have an operator here that is very simple. It's just a box operator acting on H and related to the sources. H bar, yes. I mean, very quickly, I might drop the bar. So from here on, it's all we're talking about that H bar. But thank you. So this is our goal. In maybe again, if you remember your electromagnetism course, one way of solving an equation like this, the box with respect to some source, was to do it through the Green's function. And so you don't remember that. Let me just remind you. So we would state that suppose you have solved the following problem. The same operator acting on some function, which we call this the Green function, in terms of some coordinates, let me just put it this way, with a source given by delta, four-dimensional delta. So we have, which tells us if we have a source that is sitting at x equal to y, what would be the function that determines if we're an observer at x, how this function behaves with that source that is somewhere there. So in what we're picturing, if you want this, something like that. This is our x sigma. And we're looking on the past null cone and explore what the source is doing within, actually, on the boundaries of this. I warn you, we're going to introduce all sort of simplifications or assumptions along the way, which makes sense for the regime that we're thinking. We're in the weak field regime. Sources vary very slowly. And we're going to keep introducing one thing after another one to try and make contact with something that is manageable in there. So, but if we have that Green function, then the solution formally is just simply plugging essentially into here, and we can write HAB as the integral over the source with the Green, convoluted with the Green function. So solution to this equation says HAB bar of at the point x sigma is the integral over the full space of G of X sigma is sigma with, and I forgot the minus 16 pi here, with the source, which for us is TAB. And iterated over the body. And remember, everything here is we're doing with respect to our background. Our background is flat, so I don't need to worry about kind of volume elements here, curving of space-time, this over that flat space-time. Okay, so. We have yet to, that's formal, but we have yet to say what that G, what the solution of that problem is. So we just can just, yes.
Based on this, it looks kind of like the Green's function is like.
Oh, really? Let's make G equal 1. Let's throw the G.
Oh, okay.
That's, that may be, is that where the confusion was? Yeah, yeah, thank you. Okay, so this is formally, up to here it's all formal. We haven't made anything useful except written this formal expression. We need to now find the solution is to use the appropriate Green's function solution. And the Green's function solution, again, for flat space-time has a very simple expression. It's G of X sigma minus Y sigma is, let me just get the factors right, minus 1 over 4 pi X minus Y. Delta, and I need to do x minus y minus x0 minus y0. So hold on for a second so that I can tell you what these things are. So I can, for a moment, let's put this. Times beta, the Heaviside functions of x0 minus y0. Okay, so in here, this still is a delta, but we have split the spatial part and the time part of the labels x sigma and y sigma. So we're writing x. Oh. And the same thing for y.
Okay, how did we find that?
So this is a solution, so we're not going to get in here. We can discuss later, but I mean, this is something that is a standard Green's function solution for the box operator in flat space-time, which you would have used also in electromagnetism by doing the analog calculation. But we can go there later, but for the moment, let's take it this way. So here, theta is a Heaviside function, so theta is 1 if x0 is greater than by 0, or yeah, and 0 otherwise. So what we're doing is essentially that. So now we're looking at the retarded. Let's not use that word. So I'm sitting here. Sorry, that wasn't meant to be a joke. There's a retarded and advanced. And I said, well, but I don't want to get into discussing retarded and advanced. So let's imagine you're here. And you're going to the past. You're going to make contact with the source through these. And that will determine what the h is. I tend to joke quite a bit, but I wouldn't have done. I wouldn't have made that joke. In fact, I didn't even realize you could make a joke that way. Now you have. Okay, so I plug that in here. And the solution then becomes 4. I threw away the g, 1 over x minus y. So it's measuring the distance to the source. So how did we arrive here? We plug this in there, and we use the integral, use the time part integral along the t direction there to get rid of this delta. And so whenever we see the x0, we can replace back by the x minus y. So doing that, we arrive at this, which essentially saying now something that we begin to recognize. Says, okay, so we're iterating over T3Y. So here, let me just tell you what this T is. So it's TX. So it's telling us that these have singled out for us the pieces of TAB that contribute along the cone. This one is T minus the separation between where we are, which is X, and wherever we see the source, which is the Y. So if TAB, we have a source over here. The intersection of the cone with that source is what this thing is picking up. So far, this is as far as we can go. Let me just say one more thing. I'm going to define TR to be T minus the X minus Y. And this R stands for the retarded time. So far, this is as far as we can go unless we start putting some more structure. So one thing we're going to do is to consider first the Fourier transformation. So we're going to go into Fourier space with this. Yes?
This X minus Y, is that the spatial component?
No, this is X. Yes. Sorry. Okay. Unless I put a zero, yeah. Go ahead.
Is the notation saying that TAB is a function of X and Y?
No, this is that you're going to evaluate where at the time, so your observation is T, this you're here, this you're here at TX, and you're trying to see where in your past null cone you're making contact with the source.
The first part is the time, and then Y.
Yeah, this time got replaced here, and this is the Y, and we iterate over Y. Second, yes.
Also on the Y?
Yes. Yeah, so this, the interval in time allow us to kind of get rid of the delta, and now everything is happening in space. So the next thing we're going to do is to now say, let's make some headway in here by doing a Fourier transform of that. So we can recall H. I'm going to use now Twiddle to denote the Fourier transform, so HAB, and we're doing Fourier transform in time. We're going to let space as it is. It's formally 1 over square root of pi, the integral dt, e to the I omega t. So if we had HAB of t and x, and we perform this integral in time with respect to sum of omega, this would give us the H twiddle AB with respect to omega. The next things we're going to do is use our expression for HAB of TFX and rewrite this. So we're going to have now this is 1 over square root of 2 pi. And then I have the integral is because of where we're evaluating things, t minus xi, we can do a transformation to a change of variables so as to then make it explicit that we have tr here, the retarded time. So the next step is just simply And all that work was simply to then arrive at a situation where we started what we get to. So this is, would not have been the H twill, it would have been H bar. Sorry about that. So the only thing we did is something that intuitively you can guess that you should have obtained. You say, well, let's postulate H transform into Fourier space in time. So then we relate it with that is giving our source, well, our source, our function h bar in t and x. But we have written in terms of the stress any source, the stress any contribution, which is this one. But now what you have, what you see here is that we have an integral in time of e to the I omega t of the source. So what this is just the Fourier transform of the source. But we had a function, so if we look at it here, and we transform Fourier transform this t to write in terms of frequency, then it would be the same thing if you do it here. So now we have moved our problem from kind of time into frequency domain. And the reason we did that is because we're going to begin to pull a few tricks or approximations to make sense of this. Okay, I'm now call it TAB. It's our Fourier transform of the source. Okay, so now let's second. Yeah, sorry, my four. Thank you. So now what we're gonna do is just think about the source. So we're trying to relate the solution that describes our waves, let's say, with the source, but let's think about the source. So if I think of that source again, that source over there, there's two objects. We're saying it's they're far apart, they produce weak curvature. They're not super extended, so the a gravitational wave moves at the speed of light. So there is some time, let's say, over which the speed the gravitational wave will go through each object, or for all general purposes, also through the system. And what we're going to say is that any characteristic scale intrinsic to the system is much, much, much more longer than that. So the amount of time that will take a signal to go through, like the time-like crossing time, is much shorter than anything else. So if an object is moving, it moves very slowly when compared with how much it would take this a photon to go from one end of the object or to the other one. So that's an assumption, but for sources that are slowly varying, it's perfectly good. So what we're saying is that you want the time scale of light across, of light, or by that I mean of light speed, or anything that moves at light speed, is roughly given by the extent of the source. Let's imagine it's delta r. So we, again, this is what we're thinking. We have an observer. The source is somewhere here. Let's say it has that width. That's the time scale of something going across that. Now, any time scale characteristic of the source will be roughly, well, 1 over its natural frequency. And we're saying that delta r is much, much smaller than 1 over omega. We're going to work under this assumption.
This omega is different from the omega of the gravity.
Oh, shoot, yes. But very soon we're going to come back to that omega. So let's call it omega characteristic. And so far, that integral is any omega, but very soon we're going to make contact with this omega, because we're about to throw a whole bunch of things away. So one thing is, for instance, this thing. Sorry, x minus y. So what this thing basically is telling us, the amount of time to light, or anything propagated at the speed of light, really doesn't care about the extent of this object, because it just goes by so quickly. And as it goes by, any characteristic change of the source is irrelevant. Right? So to leading order, what we're going to say is this thing, e to the I omega, r.
Where two objects are far enough from each other?
Yeah, it's sufficiently far, but you're infinitely far. So your separation with respect to the source is much, much larger than anything else. The curvature associated to each of those sources is very, very weak. And any time variation, we're going to connect with that towards the end of today, or I hope, if not early tomorrow. Any characteristic frequency of the system, for instance, the spiral frequency or the orbiting frequency is.
Frequency is what we are measuring.
Yeah, we're going to connect with that. In fact, it will be a factor of two, but it's about the same. And you'll see very clearly why there is a factor of two. But let's go slowly. So what we're saying is e to the I omega. So any difference of this, remember what this is x, is where we are. Y is any point of the source. As we do the integral, we should vary over all points that describe the source. But to leading order, it doesn't matter where we are on that source. So we're evaluating a piece. On that end, to leading order, it's the same thing. We just approximate the exponential of a given frequency times the distance to any particular point of the source by just the exponential of the frequency times the distance to the source. And where in that source, it doesn't matter. We can pick the center of mass if that's something you could define. We can't, but approximately say, if you pick the center of mass of the system or any other object or any other point of interest, then this is a reasonable approximation. And then same thing here. We have just changed, gotten rid of a piece over there. So this allows us to now write H will AB or e to the I omega r divided by r times integral of d3y till ab omega y. Okay, so now we're ready. We're about to pull a fast one, really, really fast, I would say. So what we're going to say is recall. This relation is true, which we can write as dt h and, okay, 0b plus di hib equal to 0. Now, and this is where you begin to see why we started asking or writing things in terms of Fourier. If we have a Fourier, something in Fourier, and then we imagine that this is h has some e to the I omega t dependence times some further dependence on the space. If we take the time derivative of this one, it pulls up an I omega. And so this will give us I omega.
I'm sorry, what happened to the tilde?
I forgot.
Oh, okay.
I omega h 0 b. So there's a relation between the spatial derivative and multiplications of I omega. And there is also, because of our gauge, this is why it's important, our choice of gauge. And so any time derivative just pulls out an I omega. And we can replace, if we care, any I omega contribution by spatial derivative. So we're going to do that twice very soon. So the first thing is, so we're here. We're trying to do something with this. And so one thing we can do.
The condition wasn't with h tilde. It was with h bar.
No, it was with h tilde. Oh, sure. You're right. So what if there's that? Think of that. Now, that's what it's like. If we're now thinking that this is the time dependence goes like e to the omega, thanks, that was a good point. I was going too fast there. So then it determines this relation. But it is, you can, this implies essentially the same thing on the Fourier side.
Why is h bar e to the I omega CFI?
If you want, you can imagine it's a, you could have used that as an approximation. Just any you can use Fourier modes. So if I have a function of t and r, I can choose to then, assuming there is a separability, but we're already separating things because we're saying things are very slowly varying. I can then say this is some function of time and some function of r. And then I use the fact that I can use a Fourier basis to write this in terms of sum of e to the I omega t's times sum f of r. Right? So if you want, you can think of it this way.
There should be an integral or a sum or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, there is sum, but we're keeping omega fixed. So there's a full sum, but then when we connect with this, this will be the, all the natural frequency that the source has.
So you're basically pulling the Fourier transform inside the derivative. But why are you allowed to do that? Because
so if you want, let's say, if you don't want to think of,
you're saying that this equation is valid for each of the modes.
Yes, for each mode we have it the same thing. Okay, so what are we going to do now, which is fast and is weird, and why would we have done it? Okay, in some sense, we're trying to make one connection. We're going to rewrite this thing, which has an integral in y. And we're forcefully, because notice what this is saying. It's saying you can relate time something else with space something else. So we're going there. We're going to try and rewrite this thing. And in principle, it has all components that we can think of, two components on purely the spatial side. And at the end of the day, what we're going to do is just understand that this relation tells us something about our gravitational wave and what the source is doing with respect to multiple moments of the source. Our goal is to then turn this into something that it only knows about the spatial part of the stress-energy tensor, which we then can connect easily with our this multiple distribution of the source. Good question.
So the A index over there, everything is being done in a specific coordinate because we chose like H.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
But then the Fourier transform T over there.
Yes.
That T, is it the same or different from this T?
It's the same. Yeah, we're going back and forth in the same. As if you want, I could have avoided going there if I just said from the get-go, imagine that you're rewriting everything with respect to Fourier modes in time, assuming separability. It's an analog, would have been a completely analog calculation. So what we do is just take this guy and then write it this way. Let me do it this way first. So, okay, now let me just discuss this first. We're doing an integral with respect to only the spatial part. This thing will tell us that at any moment, the spatial components determine the time components, if I care. So if I only look at the spatial components, I can then use relations of this sort to get the output. So what I'm going to do now is just say, think of only doing through I and j. We're going to focus only on the ij's. And if we find that there is something that where time is included, we can always backtrack by those kind of relations. So this is what we're doing now. We had the integral of the spatial component of the Fourier transform part of the stress-energy tensor. This, rewrite it this way. So I threw in, so here we just have the structure in a tensor. I said, imagine you throw in it some component, spatial component yj. And we're writing this in terms of using for iteration by parts. So the derivative of this will give me the derivative of this piece.
Yj is downstairs.
Times yj. Yeah, I can. Remember, we can do. I can flip up and down, and this j is a lowercase j that I cannot write. So if I imagine this, this will have a piece that takes a derivative with respect to t times y, which I'm getting rid of by this subtraction, and another piece that is the t times the derivative of y with respect to j, which gives me a delta, which gives me back that. The reason I do that is because now I have a divergence on the flat space, on the spatial part, which if we think that the source is isolated, it doesn't extend all the way to infinity, I can throw this away. Yes?
Sorry, can you explain again what y is?
So I have t, right? What I'm secretly trying to do is rewrite this thing in terms of other things. I'll go there. But I can, what I can do is just say this thing, what we're doing, let me say, integral of f being whatever in y, is the same as the integral of d of f times y dy minus df times y. Just because, think of this, and then do Leibniz here. This will give you the partial derivative with respect to f times y plus f times the derivative of y. That will give me a 1, which would be this. And then, but the first one will cancel that one. So this is why I said we're pulling a fast. This is by no means obvious that we would have had to do that. But we're eyeing where we want to end up with.
Sorry, what about indices? Because we used to have
nj3
and...
Oh, OK. So then I have to work out there. Thank you for that. So. Yes. And this, let me write it this way. Yeah, thank you.
I think in the second term, we are still missing I.
Second term? Yes, sorry. Perfect, thank you. So we throw this away, and we just keep this one. Now we come in here, and we said, oh, but the spatial derivative, we can relate it by I omega times the one that has one time component and another one spatial. So I can then rewrite this guy under our assumption as the integral of d3y I omega t, what do I want to use?
First term zero.
This one? Yeah. So we have a partial derivative of a whole thing. So that's the same as in
you're going to boundary.
I'm going to the boundary because my source is isolated. So now this I rewrite as t zero I omega. Yj. And if we did it once, we can do it twice. So here, notice what I did. I managed to get rid of one of these indices and replace it by a time index times a y vector component. And I omega. The I omega is what knows about the gradient. But we do it again. Yes.
So how did we go from t tilde with downstairs indices on the first line to upstairs indices on the second line, and then
so indices up and down, I can move them as I please.
Is it only like when they're summed over? Yeah, but are all of them summed over?
So. No, when they're sum, because if they're not sum, I can, I mean, okay, good. If there are some, I can flip it up and down, that's fine. But here, because we're in flat space-time, and we have signature minus, plus, 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 the placing of the index doesn't matter. I can bring it up and down. It won't change anything, because the metric is exactly one there. If I bring up and down the zero, then I have to be careful, because that up and down means a minus sign. But if I have two of them, then I can go up and down, because it will be minus, minus. And that's what we're about to do. We have T0i. I can do exactly the same thing. I can imagine, oh, there is an ry in here. We're doing the partial integral. And at the end, we have we're going to end up picking up d, the partial derivative of this guy, which we said, oh, but then we can do it again. And so as a result, we go into d3y, d0, 0, minus omega squared, because we pull up another I omega, ij. So if you put all those together, what you find is the following.
How does that work? We plug in zero for I and then we pull out another y or something?
So see what, let's just backtrack to what we did here. We had Tij. We said, okay, rewrite that thing. So first, we chose to only look at the spatial components, and we said they are fine because if I have the spatial components, I can then use my gauge to obtain the time spatial and the time component. So in principle, we said, okay, if let's go after only the spatial components. So we focus on the spatial components, we have that.
Yeah.
Here we use our trick of writing in terms of the derivative of something that has a vector shoved in, and then the vector times the gradient of our Fresenel tensor.
Yeah.
Then we use, again, our gauge condition, together with our kind of rather strong assumptions of what the source is doing, that is slowly varying, that is localized, that is isolated, to then say, oh, but if I have a spatial gradient, I can write it as I omega times one of them flip to a time. But if we do it once, we can do it twice. And so when I do it for a second, because this index is free, b, so I could have done this one, right? So the same goes true. So that pulls up a second I omega.
Can we do that because it's symmetric, the h?
We can do that because this is we have four conditions here. So we can do it for b equal to zero, or we can do it for b equal I, if you want. So we have, if you want, think of it this way.
But the choosing the first or the second index to make zero, is that, can we do that just because h bar is?
If you want to think of it that way, yes. Or if we do it, we keep track of the order, because here we chose which vector to contract. But I mean, it's the same thing. And then we end up here, which.
Didn't we say that our T is just the spatial part? How are we putting an index?
Good. So this was only the spatial part. Yeah. But if you want, we have this rule that says the spatial part can be related back. So we went in and out of it. So that's why I started saying with the warning, we're pulling a really fast one. But once you put all these together, then you end up with this. Oops. Where? We have yet to define this. Hold on. I have to design some define.
Line to the last line, you use the trick again?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we use it twice. So we use it more than once. We use it in one direction to say we only need to care about the spatial part. We don't need to worry about the time part. And then we use it in the opposite direction to say, oh, but we can bring it back to write. But see what we're getting. So once, let's just get here, and then we'll realize all pain is justified.
I was wondering, why the symmetry between ij is
the third line?
Say again? Why the symmetry between ij is broken at the third line?
What the symmetry between I and J is broken the third line? Good question. I mean, I can unbreak it. I mean, I can do it because I could have chosen the opposite. So if you want, I can write this Tij as 1/2 Tij plus 1/2 Tji. Great question. But I mean, it's easy to then address it. So I can write this as Tij as 1/2 Tij plus Tji. And then I contract with the R one, and then I recover it that way. But yeah, so.
The symmetry broken because basically what you did is you got rid of the full derivative, so it's probably just a boundary condition away from being symmetric.
No, I think it's hidden.
Yeah.
In that, so I can go back and then rewrite this in a symmetric way, but I think. If one wants to be absolutely careful, I should have perhaps presented that way. Thank you. So let's do it. If we did it three times, we might as well do it a fourth time. So what do we have here? We have the stress. So notice that. So we have the Fourier transform of this guy, minus 2 omega squared, something that knows about how far we are from the source, and what's it omega frequency. And here is what? Okay, that's IIJ, which is, notice this is the quadrupole of the source. Okay, what was T00? Was the density, remember? It was the density that observed it's at rest.
You missed the 2 there? Was it because the coefficient was 4, now it's 2.
So what did you do? Let me, that might have been due to the Fourier transform. Let me keep track of that. I'll present that later. So it's rather related to this. This is the quadrupole of the source. But it's a quadrupole of the source multiplied by omega squared. And those things remind us of time derivatives. We can go back again and write this. Hold on, wait, let me just make sure. Oh, good. That factor, I had to do an iteration by parts here. And now I have y squared. So I pick extra factor for 2. I'll show it explicitly. But that, when you do, right, then you have a 2. And then if you want to cancel things there, you have to make sure that factor of 2 is taken care of. So I can then choose to then go back to the untransformed case. I went back to T. Multiplications by omega are related to derivatives. So what did we do here? We just took that and went back to the time representation, not the omega representation. Any factor multiplication of omega is like one derivative, but we have omega squared. That's like 2 derivatives. And so this is what we end up with. I forgot an e to the I. Yes.
When you use I understand that you can multiplication by I omega is the time derivative of H bar.
Yes.
But why is that true for the stress tensor?
Oh, sorry, I did. Hold on. Why is it true for the stress tensor?
You're applying it for the stress tensor, but you just applied it only for the metric H bar.
Sorry, I need to. we'll check this. Go ahead, sorry.
So you assume the form of the solution and you justify that its time derivative is I omega for the metric.
Yes.
But you're using it on the stress tensor. And the metric and the stress tensor are not related by something straightforward.
Let's see. I'm going to go back to where was it? I can do it here. So, we're taking derivatives of HAB. Here, I can pull the derivative inside the integral. These are formal derivatives acting on the components. So, I can take this one and relate it to that one. So, I think that would be my justification. Let's just double check. No, let me do something else. Not that. We have an analog to, remember, I can say that, but I can also say it this way. We had that. We also have, because the stress energy sensor has to be conserved. So we also use that one. Let me just, here is 2 over R. The e to the I omega gets Fourier transform back to over R. And then this is an integral that has to be evaluated at the right target time. So what we find is that if we have an observer here that's trying to compute what the kind of difference of the perturbative field is behaving like, as connected with the source, it's related to the integral on its path null cone of whatever source we have. Compute the quadrupole out of it, and we take 2 time derivatives. So out of this, we see a couple of things that are important. First, again, remember this I, when I take the Fourier back, this will be the density. So what we're saying is we're relating this with the standard stress energy tensor, multiple tensor, is D3y, rho, yi, yj. This is what we're recovering. We have a slightly different kind of, we put T00, but essentially this is what we have. Right? So this is a quadrupole. So the first thing we notice is that the gravitational waves do not have a monopole or a dipole. We start with the quadrupole. The dipole of the source or the quadrupole of the source or the monopole of the source do not source gravitational waves. That's related to the fact that one can prove later that the center of mass of the system is conserved and the momenta of the system is conserved. We cannot lose because it cannot change, it cannot source gravitational waves. So the first contribution we have is through the quadrupole. But also the quadrupole has to be accelerated. So you could have an object that has a non-trivial quadrupole, but if it doesn't have any time dependence, it doesn't produce gravitational waves. So when we go back to that system over there, so that system over there does generate gravitational waves because we have a non-trivial quadrupole, and it rotates, then it generates gravitational wave. Of course, if you were to stop it, it ceases to emit gravitational waves. Now let me add the G, the true G, Newton's constant. And this happens to be a very small number once you evaluate sources. So I'll give you maybe a walk through an exercise to connect back to what we had over there. Yes.
Just a comment. It's interesting to relate these to the Dirichlet theorem, where by assuming spherical symmetry, we were throwing away all the multiples, and we found that there was no change of mass despite the storage grid.
Good. Okay. Yeah, so on that, something we'll try and do tomorrow, I hope. is that we can prove that gravitational waves carry energy. They carry positive energy. At the same time, I think you should be disgusted by what we have done yesterday and today. After all we introduced with respect to manifolds and geometry, and I said, seriously, is this how we're going to derive gravitational waves? I mean, do we have to rely on going to a flat space-time, making all sorts of approximations? I would say yes and no. So yes, in order to make contact with the sources, we have a very complicated system of equations. So we had to make some assumptions as to kind of how dynamic the sources were and then get something rigorous here. Because if we're going to connect with the source, we're going to a regime where we can't grab onto anything unless we make some assumptions. However, there is a really beautiful way of obtaining some of these results, purely geometrical, that rely only on asymptotic properties of your spacetime. With some bit of extra structure, you can prove that if you are sufficiently far from kind of a source, here there is a well-defined notion of gravitational waves. But the reason you can do that is just because if you are infinitely far with a few extra assumptions that are, as I said, very natural, you can prove that this observer will sense to leading order just a flat metric. And so with respect to that observer can ask, okay, what's anything that may be perturbing there because I'm infinitely far along a null direction? The only thing that can get there is gravitational waves if I'm measuring with respect to geometrical context. And then you can kind of unearth much of what we've done in a very clean, beautiful manner. But connecting with the source while requires some further assumption. So it's non-trivial. But it can, a lot of, if you have felt kind of disappointed after the first week that we had to do this, you're not alone. But I promise there is a better way, which requires some structure that we haven't looked into. But say if the Newman-Penrose formalism does that in a very natural way, using concepts of Penrose that, as I said, show that if you go asymptotically far, then you can prove with those extra assumptions that the metric will be flat here, leading order. Yes?
I'm sorry for to bring up this problem again, but the stress tensor, shouldn't it be the covariant derivative? And because our metric is not flat.
We're working to first order. So our metric is flat, and we're just looking, so we're doing the closest to the standard thing that you do in all other fields. You assume your metric is flat, and you're just looking for fields propagated on top of it. And so all derivatives are associated with the flat derivative. If, however, and this is what we're going to connect a little bit tomorrow, if we want to find out what happens to the next order, then all these things break down. And we have to do it in yet a different way.
But our crystals don't vanish even if we work to leading order.
We have chosen our coordinate system such that the metric is flat, given by minus 1, 1, 1, the flat metric. And then the Christoffel will be zero to this order. I mean, we're not computing the back reaction of the H on itself. If we do, then we have to. So the Christoffels, if you want to think of it this way. We have T is small because it's also the source. I think I know where you're going. So if I think of grad of T, I'll have d of t plus gamma times t. This is second order. Because t is the source of the h's are small, and we had that relation. But thank you. I think that's what you were asking, right? So this is ignorable, and then we have that. No, thank you. That was very useful. So now, yes, sorry.
You said that we used that, we switched spatial and time derivatives using the conservation of space.
Yeah.
So we don't actually need the Lorentz gauge because we never switched this.
So yes, if you want, you could think of it that way. But we needed the Lorentz gauge, but maybe not there. But we needed the Lorentz gauge to be there.
Ah.
Right. So this was instrumental here. So just to give you a little bit and a part of it, I'll leave it as an exercise. Let's try and connect with that one. So it's have a system, mass m. Suppose each object is a a distance r from the center of mass. So we can put a few things associated to this. So the first is to say, well, I don't know, if you use your concepts from Newtonian theory, this is the same as a particle of mass mu going around the central object of mass 2m, right? So this object mu will feel a centripetal acceleration that satisfies this relation, sorry, 2r square is 2m. I'm going to mess up with the twos here. 2r's times mu. So we can simplify that. So we get v square is, sorry, this square was here. 2m divided by 2r. And I have already messed up here. What did I do wrong? Oh, no, that's okay. Yeah, so let me double check on that. So here, this is Newton's the central object gravitational pull goes like the total mass divided by the distance square. The particle is with mass mu, velocity v square, has an acceleration v square over r. And so from here, you can get that v is m over r. And I missed something here. So roughly, it's of this order. So then omega, which is omega times r, is 2r, is m over r, which means omega m over 2r square. Omega, so, sorry, this would should have been, I did something. This is v square, omega square. Square 4 r cubed. And then omega is square root of m over 4 r cubed. Okay, that's the orbital frequency of the system as it goes around this in orbit. Yeah.
I'm confused about how we chose the volume around tensor map. Because we're assuming that we're far away from the binary system.
Yep.
And but you still are writing the energy momentum tensor as if its T00 entry is rho, which is the density of the binary system.
Yes. Okay. Good.
And if you're doing that, so your energy momentum tensor, if you can do such a thing at any place in the universe, basically, so. Shouldn't you write the right-hand side of that equation as an energy-momentum tensor that is created by everything in the universe?
Oh, sure, but we keep looking at our theoretical cow, so we think that in our space, the only thing that have in our universe, the only thing we have is these two objects, or in that the TAB that we wrote, nothing else. But that equation will say.
But how would we know that if we measure basically what happened in LIGO?
Sure.
What the frequency that we measure, how would we know that it comes from that particular source and not anything else in the universe?
Well, right. And these questions are questions, in fact, we had a talk the other day. So people distinguish kind of a gravitational wave background, that's everything else in the universe, versus individual sources. Individual sources, so a gravitational wave background is like you're too young. It used to be when you would turn the TV, there was all that crap when you didn't have a channel. Those of us that are older remember that. So you'd have, you'd have all that popcorn that is going on. But one of these, let's say, this is completely unrealistic, that example. But suppose this thing, which again, let me, it's completely unrealistic. Suppose this thing just orbits always in the, never shrinking. That will give you a monochromatic waveform that is very distinctive. So you can then generate a template that said, well, if this object this system happens to be there, whereas over there, I predict that the waveform will have to be exactly of these characteristics, and this is where we're going. So then what you do in LIGO is you then say, I have the templates with as many predictions as I can imagine, or all possible sources that I can imagine, and then I look to see if I can latch onto one of them. So you have all this noise, let's imagine this white background is all your noise, and very hidden in it, you might have this, right? At some time that you don't know, of some mass that you don't know, in some location that you don't know, but your template bank has every possible combination you can think of that is reasonable. And then you, what you do is you get this pattern, and then you match it here. You try to see, you do a cross correlation between this predefined pattern with what is going on in your noise, in your detector. And then you see that.
Significant, you say, yeah.
If the difference, so if I do it here, I get nothing. But then as I slide this through, at some point I latch onto this one, and then I see, so the detector noise is like so. And then you get that, and all of a sudden you get a blip here. That's because you picked up the extra power that is associated with this one in particular.
What would be the chance of actually measuring something that is not there, but?
Oh, beautiful. Yes. That's a great question. We can discuss this later.
Yeah, I was going to ask more specifically, like, what are the odds that that pattern is just due to, like, constructive and destructive interference of, like, random noise?
No. So this is extremely low. And also, you don't have one detector. You have several. So you'd also do cross-correlation with other detectors. So but you do have glitches every now and then. Actually, you have lots of glitches in your detector. And this is why you rely on having more than one. But a lot of these are great questions, because one thing is, we use this as an excuse to discuss a few things. We cannot shield gravitational waves. As opposed to everything else, all the other interactions, we can't. So it will go through. You cannot turn off the universe. So at any single point, you have tons of, so the LHC, you can turn it off. Then you know that you shouldn't have anything at some point. And so you can test all your background noises, all your systematics, everything that the instrument might be given in the absence of some particle that you have accelerated, right? So you can't do that with any of the gravitational wave detectors. So you rely on having multiple. You rely on having, if you have something that I think is a signal here and a signal in the other detector, they should be consistent not only what they see, but also the time of flight in between. However, what you said is perfectly correct. So what if nature is not described by general relativity? Why if nature is described by general relativity, but it's a source that has nothing to do with the sources you have thought of? So there are other techniques where you say, well, maybe I'm going to try to look for things agnostically. One thing you could do is just take noise in one detector, noise in the other detector, and begin to try to correlate every single thing. At some point, and then you're sliding because you have a detector here. So this is Earth, badly drawn. You have a detector there, another detector there. Then you have another detector there, and then there's another one in Japan that they're all working. There is a time of flight between here and there, which could be, okay, if you believe that at least we believe in Lorentz invariance, things can propagate at most at the speed of light. So you have a delta t associated with this, which bounds. So any signal or anything that you might be a signal that is seen here, that is also found there within that right frame of the delta time, then you can begin to feel confidence on that potentially being a signal. Then there are other ways where you say, suppose I do not know general relativity is correct. Suppose I don't have a way to compute. But I would expect that anything that happens in nature or some things that happen in nature are cataclysmic in nature. I expect that anything that happens very violently might give the most signal that I can get. And so then I would say, well, maybe looking for something like this makes sense. Or more cycle, less cycle, wider. And so then there are techniques or some templates that have been written with that. And so you just go in and then try to find. And then later on, you might be completely lucky. The first signal that LIGO saw, you could see it. It was so loud that you can just see it in the text. So this wasn't this. It was more like you actually saw this pattern without relying on any gravitational wave prediction whatsoever. However, that's not enough. You're not happy with just seeing there is a gravitational wave. You want to ask questions. What produced it? And then that's when you try and make contact with predictions. So let's try and make contact with one prediction. Or, of course, then what I said is, it is not true that this system will remain always at the same distance. It loses energy and angular momentum by gravitational waves. As a result, they get closer and closer. As they get closer and closer, you can still use kind of formally this. So if they get closer and closer, the distance gets shorter, which means the frequency gets higher. And this is why you see this kind of pattern. So it gets higher in amplitude, and the frequency gets shorter and higher and higher. The wavelength gets shorter and shorter. OK, so you start with that one. Now the next thing is to write the TAB. OK, so what would be the TAB? Well, let's say I have an object here, an object there. I have my center of kind of coordinate system there. Let's say they rotate in this direction, which is y, x. And so then your stress gradient tensor will be given by the mass times two delta. So we have delta for particle one plus the object two. So they are sitting at some distance away from you. They're moving around. So this is just redoing a problem that you would have done in Newtonian mechanics. So what's the quadrupole of a source associated to a binary where the objects are moving now at omega? That's what we have calculated here, the orbital frequency. And so you can compute the associated stress gradient tensor. And I'll give you as an exercise, then put everything together. And if you have any problems, let me know, and we'll just go through it explicitly. But if you put everything together, you arrive at the following expression. OK, this is important, the factors here. Let me just. I don't care about the 8, but I do care about this one. Omega squared. Zero, zero, zero. And then we have minus. And this is related to a question that we had before. So that's what the waveforms will be. And notice we can see a few things. So it's proportional to omega squared r squared, inverse proportional to the distance. So your observer, and this I realized it was something I wanted to start with, which I didn't do. So tomorrow we'll do quickly the geodesic deviation. And when we do the geodesic deviation, we'll see how it's related with this. It'll be given by derivatives of this object. But the observer, what is h? Again, what is h? H has to do with the deviations from flat spacetime. Our geodesic deviation will be related to this h, of course. And so now our observer, if you think of putting two mirrors, or as LIGO does, so it has a laser that gets sent in here, split in two. It moves in that direction, in that direction. It bounces off the mirror. It's more complicated than this description, but to leading order, this is the picture you should have. So it bounces off the mirror, comes back. This one comes back. And if they don't meet at the same time, then you could say something changed the length in one with respect to the other one. Of course, you can rule out any other possible explanation, like an earthquake, tumbleweeds hitting it, lots of things coming. Louisiana shooters that come and shoot at the arms because you're sick of coming to go around and go get after their prey. I'm not joking. That thing happens. People in Louisiana.
Really?
Yeah. If it's hot, it's humid. You're trying to hunt something, and you get here, and there's a 4-kilometer thing you have to go around. At least you're going to do a shoot at that. Yeah. Been there, seen that. Not done that. Anyway, so if they don't get together at the same time, and you can rule out any other possible explanation, then you would say a wave has passed. The important thing of that, that's so this is the strain. It's decaying as 1 over r. So you can contrast it with what you see, what you do with telescope, not radio astronomy, but the standard telescope, Galileo pointed telescope. So Galileo, or the standard telescope, is seeing what? It's seeing the flux, it's seeing energy. Energy decays as 1 over r squared. Gravitational waves decay as 1 over r. The observable decays as 1 over r. Of course, if you're doing radio astronomy, if you're feeling the field itself, there are other techniques that feel the field itself in the electromagnetic field, then it also decays as 1 over r. But it's something that helps you. The frequencies for this kind of for this approximation to work well, we don't want any frequency that is very high. So these objects are moving slowly. So if we go back to the binary pulsar, this will not give you a very large a large contribution. And then this is related to what you were saying. It goes as 2 omega t. For this case, it is equal. And it's intuitively now correct that you would have the 2. Because if I have these two objects, let's say that's your observer, the objects are going around. You get to say the same thing twice per orbital period. When this one sees at you, this one, and this why it's 2 omega t. What else? So as an exercise, just put numbers. Compute how big the strain would be. So the other thing we can see is that, OK, think of units. R goes like length. Omega goes like 1 over length. So no units here. M is length. R is length. No units here. Of course, here one has to bring back the c square. Just try and work that out. If not, I'll give it to you. And then just compute this number for the following situation. Imagine a binary. Imagine that it's separated by, so this is, imagine that it's separated by 1,000 kilometers into the 6 meters. Imagine that you're sitting, okay, the masses, let's say it's 2 solar masses, and you're sitting here at, let's, for the sake of the argument, 400 megaparsecs. Well, let's just do something simple, 100 megaparsecs. If you don't know what all these things are, I would suggest look it up. It's a useful exercise. And just put all this together and compute how big this thing is. How big a change would it make your flat space then? And you see it's pretty tiny. What else I want to say? Yeah, that's all we need here. So let me just quickly say what I was going to say earlier today. So what we, once you put, and if you want, you can try and do this exercise. If not, I promise I'll do it tomorrow. If you look at, if you go back to the geodesic deviation equation, and ask, okay, if I put the components of the stress unit tensor and of the of not the stress unit tensor of the Einstein the of the Riemann tensor using the transverse trace gauge, so you're far out. The transverse trace gauge was very convenient to describe asymptotics of gravitational waves. Then you'd be able to show that the second derivative of the separation vector with respect to tau goes like 1/2. So this is what we'll show tomorrow. So this is what I was just saying. So the observable is directly related to the h. And the h is decaying with the distance to the source as 1 over r. So that's the key information I want to give. And then we're going to use that equation to try and iterate it. And then we'll find out why we're calling the waveform or the waves plus and cross. So we're going to just explicitly show that one deforms things this way, and the other one does it at 45 degrees. This way, it's, as I mentioned the other day, it's a 45, what are the plus and cross definition. So which are sitting here. So this will be H plus, and this will be H cross. And you can kind of already see the plus here. So imagine the waveform is the wave is going by you. This will make the distance slightly shorter, while at the same time, this one is making that distance slightly longer. So the distance along xx will get shorter, along yy, so along x, along y, will be doing the opposite. If we're in the, if we look at the r direction, this one is shrinking the distance, so is that one, but in relation to what the r one is doing. So the x will be affected by where we're going y, and the y is affected by what is going on in the x. This is why they're rotated by 45 degrees. Any questions? Yes.
So this H bar object, why are the entries only in the first 2x2 part?
Because we're assuming that these things are in the plane, and the xy plane. So if you, there is no contribution of the quadrupole there.
How should we choose the coordinate to write down the stress
tensor? The stress unit tensor? For this problem or in general? So in this problem, we're assuming we're in flat space-time, so just can get a hold on everything you know in flat space-time. You're using Cartesian coordinates. You can adapt it any way you want. So here we, I'm suggesting adapt it so that this motion is on the plane. You have x, y, and then just use the standard calculation you would have done in Newtonian mechanics, because this is what we ended up doing. I mean, we worked really hard to have something at the end of the day that only involves spatial components, and we can make use of. Well, I've noticed a lot of things you can think of. So you can choose that. What is constraining is the shape of your H. So you can think of it as you adapt your coordinates. And in this, at this order, you can do that so that that relation is satisfied. So it's fine. At this order, it's fine. You're just affecting what you're finding. We're not including the back reaction.
I didn't understand.
Go ahead.
You use the flat metric for the system itself, but that's not a syntopic like state, right? Because like not state, but like near the source, like the space time is not flat.
Right. Absolutely. But we are making that assumption, and for many sources, it's fine. For this, so let's see. If you compute the velocity is rather small. So it's still not going when they are separated by a kilometer. So a 1,000 kilometers. So it's still it's rather small. So it's a fraction of the speed of light. The other thing that could be bad is m over R, but that still is going to be small. So they're orders of 10 to the minus something. So it's not going to be very strong. So it is true, there is a piece that we're ignoring, but it's to the level that we're working, we're capturing the leading approximation.
So this kind of works for like binary stars. Not
yeah, exactly. So good point. So and there is actually, we were chatting about this earlier. This works for binary stars, and that's why I said a fluffy star. So not a very compact star, so this works relatively well. In fact, the binary pulsars, the first measurements, I mean, then you can use more accurate measurements and then try and explore some other things that will are sensitive to what's going on in the sense that you're worrying about. But to leading order, that's perfectly fine. It does not work for black holes, for sure. This cannot work for black holes. However, when the black holes are sufficiently far, there is a way to represent the black hole so that when you're sufficiently far out, but for you, it's like two particles going around. And as long as those particles are going at low velocities, the dynamics is small, you can still use an approximation and it still gets it quite right. What we have not included here, so this is kind of the instantaneous effect of these two objects going around as far as the gravitational wave. What we have not included here is the back reaction. So it does not account for how the orbit will shrink. So from that point of view, it will fail to describe black holes or binary even binary stars that are shrinking, because this is not there. For that, we need to kind of go work out to higher order before you start seeing the effect on kind of the extraction of energy and angular momentum from the system, which will then make this object shrink and accelerate.
How far enough is one for the binary system?
Good. It depends. How far enough is far enough for the separation?
Yeah.
Great. So quickly, I can say that. You could try and do the following. I said, I'm going to come up with a perturbative scheme that, and we can use the expressions we described the other day. Remember the other day, we had, for instance, the derivative of the energy of the particle with respect to t, or let's say the momenta. It was what you knew from Newtonian. And then there were things that were like, went like v squared. Correcting terms that go higher than that. So here is where you have the M over R, then you have other pieces here. So you could choose to say, I'm going to introduce a perturbative expansion where V, and let's throw in the C so that we have it as a comparison, is small, or is small enough.
What is that?
V, the velocity of
the
C.
Oh,
okay. So that we can say, oh, with respect to C. So then you can go back to that equation and say, okay, the leading order piece would have been what I know from Newtonian gravity. And then I have some corrections. And I want those corrections to be small to be able to justify this. So then it will depend on you, how big an error are you willing to tolerate. Typically, if this thing stays sufficiently small, 10 to the minus something, and then it's up to you with respect to the error, then you can say, OK, say P. You can say, evaluate these guys roughly, and said, OK. The answer to that question depends on, and these are, I think, questions you asked before in a different context. Yes, when we're talking about Einstein's equation. If you're interested in a short amount of time, then you are able to tolerate a much larger error because a much larger velocity. But if you want to iterate for a very, very long time, many dynamical times, then these effects will accumulate. So what you want is to find out what's the accumulated effect of ignoring some of these orders. So there is a technique that is used very often or very commonly called post-Newtonian technique, which rely on rewriting the equation of motions of part of objects such that you include further and further contributions. So there was an earlier question on that. So if you ask, is two objects going around? How high do I have to go? So if you think Newtonian is your leading order, and then you compute post-Newtonian, post-post-Newtonian, post-post-post-post-Newtonian, you keep going, and people have gone sufficiently far in different directions. And then the question was, at what point do you distinguish a black hole from a neutron star? So imagine again, so a particle that moves with an acceleration starts with m over r, right? So which are wrote there, that would be your Newtonian. But v, m over r, and if you're thinking about circular trajectories, this is like v squared.
Newtonian is m over r the acceleration?
Yeah.
M over r squared?
Yeah, but so let's say the centripetal acceleration. So we have a goes like v squared over r goes like m over r squared. So roughly, this is what you're saying. Or if you want, you can use.
But you wrote acceleration.
Well, what I'm trying to say, the Newtonian, or positions or whatever, the Newtonian comes at this order. This is what when you do the bookkeeping. This is zero Newtonian. And then you can do any correction has this to the larger and larger order. But when you're sitting at pi pn, which is 5 is pi times 4 Newtonian, then you're talking about v over to the 10. It's only here, this deep, that you begin to say, oh, this is not a neutron star, it's a black hole. The effects, the internal effects of the object in this bookkeeping come very late. Assuming so what you're saying is, at what point, if they are sufficiently separated, do I tell apart these two objects being black holes, neutron stars, or anything that have the same mass that are going around because the effect is tiny? Of course, once they get close enough, they're going like hell very rapidly. They are curving the space-time very strongly. And so none of these approximations work. You have to go and solve the full problem.
You don't know what the... So the binary system that LIGO detected, or whatever,
yeah.
Did they know the distance of the black holes from each other when they were...
No, because, okay, great question. All distances are true. Because they start when they are born, or when they capture and they form the binary pair, they start a very, very large separation. Now they're turning the gravitational waves, the orbit shrinks, they get tighter and tighter. So you sweep all distances. So there's a regime, which is called the spiral regime or the Erlin spiral regime, where they are sufficiently far that something like this is good or good enough. At some point, they begin to move fast or too fast. How do you know it's too fast? Because you work out, for instance, the next order, and then you use the next order as a measure of the error. And then you say, do I tolerate this error or not? And what does it mean to tolerate? It means to, when you go to LIGO, do you get a not significant offset that you begin to lose sensitivity in a way that you don't get any better by following the system any longer? So that's your figure of merit.
So they traverse all possible distances.
Yeah, and then they merge, and then they go bust. They form a larger black hole. They go quiescent. So that signal that I draw here, or this signal, right? If you look at, just imagine this is a snapshot of system at some given point, just to give you at least a qualitative feature. So it has an R. So as you make the R, as it gets shorter and shorter, this gets down, but this gets up. And so this is going to give you a larger amplitude. This goes faster. So as the system progresses, yeah, it goes through everything. So LIGO sees, depending on the masses, because LIGO sees only one kind of a given frequency window. For the right masses, it sees all separations as they go in, merge into a single object.
What about the mass? They also do that for the mass as well. They say, here is our interval of the mass that we think the binary system has.
Yes.
And
right. Because, let's see, going back, if you want, to our relation, so we had it somewhere here before, omega goes like m over r cube square root. Okay. So now I'm over distance. So you can say, well, LIGO, where the LIGO sees between 10 hertz and a kilohertz. So that says I can see objects that are kind of higher masses or lower masses, depending on. So there are some objects that you see, if they are very, very massive, like the first signal, those you just saw the last two orbits and then the merger. For binary stars, the masses are much lower. They saw many, 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 many orbits till the merger is held. And if you make even, if you think you have even lower masses, you don't see the merger. You just see a lot of the spiral. And then once they come together, it's already out of your window, of your after your frequency band.
So the next question is much more simplistic. And
yeah.
Stupid. So the cross-crossing, the cross-polarization.
Yeah.
You said that because it's minus sine 2 omega t for both, well, using the same rationale, when x is diminishing, the decreasing y is also decreasing. But why would that be
cross?
So why would that
go
down?
But of course, imagine this. So we're going to do this. Imagine you have a rod. What he's saying is the effect on the rod along the x direction is influenced by the rod length in the y direction because it's sitting here. So if I imagine a vector x or length in x, length in y, do the dot product, and then it's mixing. So the x knows about the y, and the y knows about the x. This is why it's cross.
Okay.
We'll see this tomorrow. But